Log Talk Radio.
Sonic effects. You just sit back and put your seats in the upright position and fold your trays. We'll be taking off momentarily. How are you today? How's everybody? The interesting question to ask such a diverse audience and let's tuck right into the work to the show today. What's been traveling around? A good question. How are you? Is, you know, what's your sense of what's happening around? We don't exist in this bubble. Even our successes in life can leave us feeling isolated and trapped from real life. And those of you who have experienced those moments will perhaps realize or have gone through that sense of what now, what next, and the longing that just seems to generate that. The question is always, if I say to you, the world is changing, well, then you might consciously be thinking, well, what's changed? You know, our history seems to be accumulating stories about the violence we can perpetrate and the sense of accomplishment might be Alexander breaking into tears after he had conquered, as the legend says, after he had conquered all the known world. He felt so bad for himself. Well, what next? What do I do now? If that's all that we seem to have been making of history, I think we have underestimated ourselves, not both in terms of, you know, the undeniable and unidentified consequences, unpredicted consequences of our actions, and the I think is scathing kind of notion that the court jester brings to the argument, or maybe the poet. That brutal honesty. Look what we've done. Well, we have to do it in order to look back and realize it. It's like foolish to think that I can, or anybody else, any mind can say, this is what we're moving toward. And it hasn't happened yet, but we need to be aware, be mindful of this and take steps to embellish our position, embellish our, or sustain our existence in all of this. Well, you know, I could say definitely that seems quite foolish because it's we're talking about something that's hypothetical or conjecture. But we don't have that. We don't have that same smugness anymore to fall back on because we have children pointing out what the scientists have been telling us for a long, long time. We are in existential crisis. I don't know how you sort that out in a way for a person, you know, leveling the barrel of a tank at your home is a certain kind of existential crisis. And I doubt that if I'm sitting there with an RPG or, you know, different types of weaponry fighting back, that it's going to concern me greatly, that the air quality is going to concern me greatly. But that's may not be the fighter's situation, but it's ours. His situation, what's happening, is part of the landscape. It's part of the environment, part of the neighborhood, and it's inescapable. We just get over thinking that we've ended the terror, if not the legacy of one megalomaniac, and along comes another. It's as if it's a role that has to be filled, or somebody feels that it's somehow opportunity, and that they can do better. If only I was more ruthless and more lacking in empathy, if only I was more focused on my tribe and our superiority. That's where he failed. I can do this because I'll do whatever it takes. I mean, how many of those kind of statements are happening? Whatever it takes. Well, nah, we all have limits. Nah, and if not the minds that come up with this stuff, certainly the rest of us do. We have this collective moral rudder that makes us raise an eyebrow when we see some assault of behavior going on. But then it starts to awaken a resolve that is best left slumbering, the resolve to take care of this and sort it. And that never goes well for anybody. And it's happened at different times over the course of the history of humanity. And always we end up with this sense of optimism somewhere in all of this. We have the need to be carrying on our battles with a sense of purpose, a greater purpose than ourselves. Whether it's me, you know, mom and pop back home, or a girlfriend, or my family, or my children, or humanity, we have an awareness of higher power. It's not just me. It's not just me with my weapon doing what I'm doing to dominate that guy across the field. There's something we fight for principles, and even when we're burying our mates, we have that task to do. And so with that in mind, that's reality. That's reality, and it's come around again. It's come around, and I don't really know in some ways if I want to ever say that it's left us at any point. I think that would be a bit of an overstatement. But our tolerance for the news ebbs and flows. Even the most meager news outlets have taken up the cause, and now we're making some, you know, it's these histories. We're starting to learn more about, you know, fill in some of the historical injunctions, and by doing that, it extends our own history, yours and mine. Now we're part of this living history, and it will it could define us, define generations of us. And we will know with some degree of clarity very quickly how we are judging all of this process, how we're judging ourselves and our own actions. Somehow the good guys have to prevail, don't they? We need to have at the end of the day, the symbol of justice and good judgment flying over the battlefields and an end of the tyranny. It's going to take voices coming from the crowd, all of those hundreds of millions of small voices to make the peace happen. We wait for a daybreak and scurry out to get enough food and water for the day for ourselves and our families and our friends, and then huddle down to wait as the sounds of war go on outside our doors. So we don't need a clever metaphor for conversation about Masonic values and things today. And all of this, you know, I think we put a pin in some of these tasks. And it starts to redefine it. It's a period when we start to ask the serious questions. Well, Masonry has been doing that for us for a long time, since our initiation. You know, deepen the questions, deepen the thought, deepen the man. But not to say that it's all a joy and. Because I think that way. It's not all happiness, because I'm optimistic about everything in general. Well, there, I'm, you know, starting to sound like an ideologue, aren't I? You know, I'm exercising an opinion instead of dealing with what's going on around me. Everything's wonderful. No matter what you do, everything's wonderful. There's a silver lining. Well, I think I need to, instead of rushing to that conclusion, I need to understand how to get there. Today we have a different kind of emphasis going on out there. It's just an outlandish kind of a scene that we're witnessing, because it's on such a scale that. And lately, even our scale is being expanded. You know, I say it's on a massive global scale. You know, well, we're talking, what, 4,000, approximately 4,000 religions, and how many countries, how many nations? And to be able to see, there is no one uniformity happening across all of that. There's children being born, there's people being dying and being killed, and then there's a need for somebody to stay out of that kind of set themselves apart from that kind of conflict, to be concerned about the sciences of our oceans and our air, and preserve a quality of life that is worth fighting for, and knowing that this will change us. Maybe we don't necessarily know exactly how it's going to change us, but we can tell that it will change an entire generation, and that doesn't go away. The famine, living through a famine doesn't go away. You can move beyond it and respect it, but it doesn't go away. And we can live a better life and never mention the incidents that, as such, but they're always there. Resilience. We start to look at what makes us carry on. And I think we know that that a lot of people will try. You know, they've done it before. We've tried with just satisfy the brain, the mind. You know, let's do what we can to maybe it's at the bottom of a bottle of whiskey or a pipe of opium or a spoon of cocaine. Is it understandable that people would be in such pain that they would seek those kinds of remedies? Absolutely. What's the morality of suffering? Huh? It's not I don't think there's any morality involved in finding a solution. It's startling though. It's startling when you start to think that way. That the morality is questions of morality is about the extent of pain and suffering, and it gets grim. But such is life. Is there anybody's life that doesn't have an element of grimness to it? At some point, it all happens out. It all pours out. And I don't think we are. The likes of us are satisfied shrugging our shoulders and quaking in fear, saying, I'm thinking, my goodness, I wasn't prepared for this. What do I do now? Well, day by day, we can wake up saying the same thing. I wasn't prepared for this. Well, the day unfolds around us. And it's not whether we choose to, but it does. Even then, you know, today we have the scientists and academics tweaking our sense of reality and dimensions, and it's stretching our sense of reason and reasoning. Just incredible. So for anybody to think, well, this is the way it is, you come full circle. If we're saying this is the way it is, and this is a closed community, and we just recycle the same ideas over and over again, how do you explain that? How do you explain that we're still able to find? Puzzles still find us. We're still perplexed by questions. If we're repeating the themes, when I go to see a drama, I know my professors would say, well, you know, these themes were originally on the stage in Athens, and so everything else is derivative. Well, I guess you could say my entire life is derivative because it's been done before. I don't know I don't know if that person is thinking in absolute terms or relative terms. My goodness, listen to us. Hey? Here's a group of Masons talking in loftier terms than the normal conversation at the bus stop. Isn't that just the beauty of it all? We have not to convince another person. I don't think we're proselytizing here, but to affirm that somebody else exists in this state of becoming, this state of non-complacency, willing to accept set points that are consistent with this Masonic community. We do learn, you know, by natural law, not by committee. It's not pleasant. You know, I live and I think it's not the toughness of my Grand Lodge. My goodness, there's much stricter, more more pointed and precise, surgically precise Grand Lodges in the world. They, what happens though is the it's about the kind of people that are being brought into the order. Can you see it? Can you see what's really going on? And if not, then we break it down into, you know, oversimplified kind of notions, overthinking them, trying to take something so intimate and so individual and so purposeful and make it policy statements. My goodness. Fancy that. The policy here is that we're going to be content and we're going to operate as a brotherhood. That may be the aim, but and we may have the tools, but there's this little missing part, that instruction about how to use and how to apply those tools, and particularly how to apply the results to our own life. What did we learn? And where does that fit? It's an interesting conversation. Now, I don't think you walk down the street bumping into fellows with their smug little secret signs and secret handshakes and say, hey, we're going to break into this conversation. Do you mind? It's not like dancing a jig. No, it's ease into, my goodness. It's like, you know, we don't just overlook our general manners. It's like, how are you? I haven't seen you. You look well. You look like you've been dragged through the ringer. Tell me about you. Let's catch up. And we do that gradually and ease into it. Most of the things that we're talking about in our Masonic circles are like that. We ease into them. Now, you might say, well, the Masonic life exists only inside of a lodge. And I might say, well, the practice of Masonry happens outside of the lodge. We may rehearse together. We may go through keen reminders and refresher every time you walk into a lodge, all the symbolic, the information and the communication, the language of symbols. But when the way we practice it is in real life, real time, outside there, we bring it with us, knowing that the world around us is no different. It is what it is. It's with the exception that if we've been successful in applying some of these principles and values, then we're different. And then our perspective may be hopefully different, deeper. We may be able to see things that and understand things in a way that would be not evident at first glance. So here today we have a good show. Yeah, respectable. It's not going to be a waste of your time. Surrendering ego to find a peace. P-E-A, peace. That's been with us for a while, and we don't really find that very pleasant or nice for gentlemen to talk about. But it's also nice. It's not very pleasant when gentlemen can't come to terms with it. And I think what varies from lodge to lodge is the strength of those egos. They're always there. Strong egos are always around us. But when we look beyond the obvious, if you want to look where, you know, for defining something as interesting as strength, or power, wouldn't that be an interesting question to put to people in your lodge? What does it even mean? And is it at the young 13-year-old waving a pistol at me in my office? Is it the that was powerful in a way? Is it the young child facing endless cancer treatments in a hospital bed with the murmur of all these very exotic machines, keeping them company all day and all night. You know, different ways, different settings. It's fortunate that you and I have found out that we can connect and communicate over long distances and with relative privacy. Oh, let's not get started on that one, shall we? With the illusions that we want to tell ourselves. So I think if anybody is listening in, it's only going to be the person that has the truer Masonic experience is going to be able to unlock it. All the rest are going to be in the grandstands mocking us, pointing fingers. Well, that's fine. You know, it's easier to criticize the players on the field than be a player on the field and trying to compete and win the hand of the fair maiden. The show is good. We have decent music. Oh my goodness, Keith Jarrett, Michel Petrucciani. I've found pianists music today from Thelonious Monk and Bill Evans. Just and I'm dragging out a poem that I haven't touched before. It's Coleridge, Samuel Coleridge's a revelation, Kubla Khan. Fascinating, and the history. We'll find some stones through the stream of life in our history lessons today. But sit back and relax, and fill up your mug with your favorite and necessary libation, and let me try and inform and entertain. This is something that'll help us all get into this mood. Keith Jarrett Trio, You Won't Forget Me. Thank you. goodness. What a nice way to start anything. My goodness. You know, you see symbols around us, plenty of symbols in masonry, it's considered wise to begin to question what they mean. But it's a question that I put to all of you, if you're sitting down, what is it about the symbols and the ritual that you draw out? What can you draw from them that makes a difference in a person's life? What do you draw from them? I think for me, immediately directed to the question, how do I go from here to reading and learning about these principles and then applying them and I presume the question is not just empty, but is substantive. How do these things improve the quality of life? I'll leave that with you a little bit. Here we have the symbols that lead us to, we absorb what's going on around us, as I've been hinting at since the start, probably too much for most listeners. I've been hinting at the notion that what we see isn't always, pretty, but it isn't always glowing. We have this sense of understanding it. I may be quite angry about some things and get upset and repulsed by some of the things that are happening in the world around, but and at no time do I think it's better to stick my head in the sand, at absolutely no time. Or at no time am I thinking here, throwing my hands in the air and saying, oh my goodness, is it, it's just too much. Too much, my dad, be damned, it's too much. Bring it, because there's a lot. There's always been a lot going on. And I like to ensure that I can pass on to my children and next generations a sense of understanding, not complete, but a sense of understanding, a sense of the important, my vitality and my place in this landscape and what's going on around them. Because there are things that ought to matter to us. I'm not saying for a moment that pre-Reformation the world was simpler or easier. That's just a ridiculous kind of rhetoric, loose talk. And it was difficult. Our life expectancy was a blink of an eye compared to what I have today, what you and I have today. And the threats, what we see now is the threat of life expectancy in some country is war. It's not disease or poor quality water or a diet. It's war, bullets and bombs and shrapnel and all that. What we're doing to ourselves, but points fingers. It's like taking a pointer. It's not a finger. We won't use that. Pointing out our frailties. We are still vulnerable to certain things. We're vulnerable to hard conversations, the truth within the truth. We can be terrible about it, ruthless. Any young woman that's a teenager is not going to be allowed to go to school. There's that kind of ruthlessness. And yet the appetite for learning doesn't stop. And it will go on because it was just using that as an example. You can't kill ideas. If you're if I'm sitting there trying to square myself with the great creator, the grand creator of the universe on my last day and my last breath, and somebody is to say, what have I learned? Well, you can't kill ideas. You can't kill ideas. That's a certainty. And it's not this tripey, insufferable smugness of death and taxes. Come on. No, you can't kill it. You know, you want a certainty, you can't kill ideas. So it's not just that you say it out loud and that makes the world a better, more accepting kind of a place. It's like, if you try to kill ideas, we're going to stop you. We're going to stop you because all you're doing is creating a hell of a lot of damage. And it's pointless. If there was a point to it and we could understand the point, then we would be there. We would be there. But you're off. You know, you can go off and do something quite abhorrent and doesn't make it right. In fact, you're going to be corrected. You will be one way or the other. And the correction that we have established, as circuitous as our thinking and logic might be, is to come up with some sense of principle that we can live with and move forward. Those conversations, educate your kids, educate yourselves. The more we're educated, the better we understand. Doesn't mean that everybody applies that evenly or is in a situation to apply it evenly, but that knowledge, that accumulated knowledge continues. And along with that, we hammer away at ego in our lodges, don't we? Now, you've been in a lodge with powerful egos. It doesn't seem to be necessarily a problem unless they don't know how to interact. Or unless there's such a level of immaturity that there's a clamor for supremacy. No, this is still the need to be so fine-tuned, so tuned into the groove that you know when it's your front and center, when you need to be able to perform your skills with all that subtlety. Surrender ego to find the peace is the way I'm presenting this. If we peel away all the external thoughts, there is no better find than realizing the transformative elixir of masonry has always been a heartbeat away. Learn the lessons well, entered apprentice. Those lessons will serve you well as you move on. Before the sublime degree found its way into our rituals, the fellow marked completion until the legend of Hiram Abiff was being told, with references carried from perhaps the most esoteric and misunderstood books of Christian scripture, Revelations. Do you deserve the joy of clear vision and clearer thinking? When you can answer that, and you have made yourself as worthy as a scholar who has taken understanding as far as his peers made known to him. When you realize if you truly are ready and deserving, your happiness will cease to be dependent on others or anything and be completely within your grasp. Brethren, provide the backstop, encouraging struggle, failing and excelling similarly, with the illusion of determinism as shattered and ego begins to crack, that metaphoric lightness begins to shine through. The truth of mathematics and honesty of the arts is yours to enjoy, yours to benefit. The task becomes exactly what it is. To live like this is positivity itself. This patience finds its way to others when you take action. Allowing actions to speak for you is humbling and explains leadership by example. It explains the leadership by example has a calming effect. even the fates are in play. Doesn't matter. Well, life is what happens in between these moments of inspiration and clarity. Life. It's always, it's a dynamic. It's an approximation. It's a, and it moves, and our minds have the ability to make this all coherent and consistent, because, you know, because our minds, you know, absorb a tremendous amount of energy from what's taken in. What are we? What's it absorb? About 60%, 70% of the energy that's we absorb and create. And we can fill in the blanks. It does that for us. It finds that it's more efficient. It's more efficient, and our minds, in spite of us, find the efficient route. So my goodness, it's important that the routes that we find are within due bounds, have some sense of morality and ethics. Yeah. So we don't just fall into the darkness. How far do we go? Do I all want to invite Aleister Crowley to sit in with us and talk about the exploration of self and meaning? Well, he's standing up declaring that there are no boundaries for this. We're going to have the experience, and then we'll talk about boundaries. Yeah, well, Aleister, interesting dude. Or we can do that symbolically, can't we? Yeah. And if we have some degree of intelligence, we can learn from the experiences of other people. Oh, my, we're beginning to sound like higher education here. Michel Petrucciani, the late Michel Petrucciani, will take us to the next level right here.
Kids seem to pick up music almost effortlessly, while for the average adult, it's a painful grind.
There you go. Didn't know that, did you? Thank you. complete with an ad, eh? Michele Petrucciani. Nice music, though. Still, beautiful music. I know that you listen to your poetry. I know you do. Some of the older nations aren't as awkward about it. Listeners from those nations out there will know they revere their poets, and it's part of their oral history. Me, I'm in a sort of a nation of bus stops, and people are coming and going, and we're still beginning to unpack and beginning to discover the neighbors aren't so bad. And there's some interesting things going on. And when we're not trying to make a living, the quality of life here is pretty good. Not ideal and perfect, but pretty good. And yet things are going along well enough that we have a small leisure class. You know, they're there. But the quality of education, you know, what we're unleashing is we're enlisting and acknowledging the brilliance of and the equality of women here. Fascinating, just fascinating process that's unfolding, and for the betterment of all, from governance right down to the workplace, we benefit from it. All of that said, poets, you stumble across poetry. We turn on our radios every time we get in our cars and we listen to poetry. Often our poetry is set to music. And when we begin to listen to the lyrics, we find some of it very comforting. Some of it's quite simple. It's just a catchy little tune with a short, clever few lines. But other cultures, their renditions are just glorious illustrations of history and very beautifully constructed. Here today, we're going to tip into one of those beautifully constructed pieces of work by a person that was I would say tortured by his sensitivity. Studying the work today of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, it's an interesting little poem, Kubla Khan, that we're going to tip into. He has titles that he creates titles that just are astounding, like Kubla Khan, the Ancient Mariner, Christabel, Frost at Midnight. You know, it's like, what in the world? Almost unnecessary, one might think, to turn back to the poems themselves at all. Those proverbial titles seem to hold all the poetry. So it's easy to forget how strange and how captivating and how haunted Coleridge's actual poems are. What is it, for example, that so many of them are set at night? Why do their outer landscapes always dissolve into some inner dream worlds? Why are they so full of guilt? And yet, why are they all so often fused with beautiful, healing, glimmering moonlight? One answer to all these questions has always been drug addiction. Step forward, Coleridge, the lyrical smackhead. Coleridge's poems are explained away as forms of drug-induced hallucinations. It's certainly true that Coleridge began taking opium as a schoolboy in London and experimented with it throughout his 20s in the Western country in Germany, and was seriously addicted by the time he settled in the Lake District in 1801, aged 29. Five poems in these selections have a sufficiently bewildering range of traumatic subject matter to be classed as psychotic. In clinical notes, they might be described as sexual fantasies of a Mongol warlord, the hallucinations of a paranoid sailor, the hysteria of a young woman assaulted by a lesbian demon, and the masochistic mutterings of a suicidally depressed lover. They end with the first ever and truly terrifying poem of drug withdrawal, The Pains of Sleep. He wrote that in 1803. It's also true that Coleridge, like many addicts, was incapable of domestic stability. He abandoned his wife and three children in 1804, traveled restlessly for 12 years, Malta, Sicily, Italy, London, Leicestershire, the lakes, and then back to London. 1816, in the attic room of a kind physician, James Gilman. That was it. Opium is a feeble explanation for Coleridge's genius. It's like, if you could create that genius through opium, man, there'd be a hell of a lot more people trying to tap into that, and that's just not the case. Coleridge was quickly thrown out of both university and the army. He was discharged insane. He had an unhappy marriage and failed to establish a promising career in either journalism or the church. But instead, in 1797, he met William and Dorothy Wordsworth, and he became a poet. His career was marked by intellectual brilliance, financial chaos, a painfully emotional dependence on the Wordsworth household. That household includes Wordsworth's entrancing sister-in-law, Sarah Hutchinson, with whom Coleridge fell desperately and unrequitedly in love. This part of his story is still little known, even to those that would exploit it. Sarah is the secret subject of Dejection, but also dozens of his later poems, including the one written 30 years later when he was 61, Love's Apparition. Like all the romantics, you know, that focus on inner awareness and nature, Coleridge was interested in exploring extreme states of mind and feeling, the dark groundwork of our nature, as he called it. But he was unusual in that he combined this with a lifelong fascination with philosophy and psychology and the physical sciences, especially chemistry, through his great friend Humphrey Davy. And these gave him extraordinary range and authority and depth. In a memorable snub to the philosopher Goodwin, an early proponent of the two cultures, Coleridge announced, quote, "The activity of science being necessarily performed with the passion of hope, it is poetical." He was never sentimental in his poems, though frequently so in both his life and his letters. He proved himself a heroic weeper and moaner on many occasions. But he would also be very funny and self-mocking, and one should add immensely lovable. Coleridge was fascinated by the way the imagination works, and he distinguished it from what he called superficial fancy and described it in a wonderful phrase as the esemplastic or shaping power. Beautiful word, esemplastic. He invented the influential notion of the willing suspension of disbelief. That's taught in drama classes in our universities to this day. He cultivated the impression that his poetry was uncontrolled and spontaneous. He defined poetry not as a controlled, uncontrolled hallucination, but as an act of supreme attention. And it can be said and should be said that Coleridge is often paired with his great friend and colleague William Wordsworth, but they are utterly unlike each other, both as men and as poets. You either love one or the other. Here, the speaker in the Kublai Khan describes the stately pleasure dome built in Xanadu, according to the decree of Kublai Khan, in the place where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea, as it says. Walls and towers were raised around twice 5 miles of fertile ground, filled with beautiful gardens and forests, a deep romantic chasm slanted down to a green hill. So listen for these things. As air beneath the waning moon was haunted by a woman waiting to her demon lover, Kubla heard ancestral voices bringing prophecies of war. Now, as of course he would, eh? Beautiful scene. Of course he's going to end. And he has this enchantress in his dream. Of course he's bringing news of war. A sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice. The speaker says that once he saw a damsel with a dulcimer, an Abyssinian maid who played her dulcimer and sang, "Ah, Mount Abora." He says that if he could revive her symphony and song within him, he would rebuild the pleasure dome out of music. This is one of his best. In Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately desert dome, pleasure dome decree where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea, so twice 5 miles of fertile ground, with walls and towers were girdled round, and there were gardens bright with sinuous rills, where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree, and here were forests ancient as the hills, enfolding sunny spots of greenery. A damsel with a dulcimer in a vision once I saw. It was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora, could I revive within me her symphony and song? Mm. To such a deep delight 'twould win me that with music loud and long I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware. His flashing eyes, his floating hair, weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise. That works, doesn't it? Yep. Just delicious music. Delicious. Delicious. Here we pick up on our sense of continuity. I'd like you to think that the history that you learn or that you take in, it becomes an extension of you. And you become extended by it in some way, on some level. It's about what we're talking about, our experiences. Remember, we closed off with what was going on in around London, you know, the fashionable Whig circles and the private clubs that were happening around 1689, you know, the notorious Kit Kat Club. They called its members knights and had a president who taught what faith the priests of all religions hold. But in 1711, it sponsored a large public procession through the streets of London that culminated in the burning of an effigy of the Pope. Whoa. The Reformation and the Enlightenment really took off, didn't it? Hundreds of years. 100 years, eh? All of these experiences could have been sources for the imported terminology employed by the Knights of Jubilation. Ah. And if the document from The Hague found in Toland's possession, you know, John Toland, the free thinker, he's considered a free thinker, just out of the box kind of guy. They were dated, these two documents were dated 20 years later, say 1730. And we would have also had no trouble connecting the men at this meeting with early and official Dutch Freemasonry. We study Dutch Freemasonry because they kept good records. And it was one of those stories where, you know, people have visited and they've taken away impressions and they're talking about the impressions. And my goodness, you know, it's like the first glance. When somebody comes into your workplace or to your group, those fresh eyes have there's a value in asking what the fresh eyes see. And some managers and owners do that because they're smart. The writer of this meeting record is Prosper Marchand, and he was a longtime and intimate friend of Rousset de Missy, the master of the Amsterdam Lodge Le Bien Ami. We've read about that before. Rousset's name appears in the official roster of brothers in 1734. And he was one of the principal architects of the movement, becoming the master of Le Bien Ami before its disbanding in 1749. Thus, the link between Toland and the Knights of Jubilation leads from Marchand to Rousset, and hence to the earliest official history of Freemasonry in continental Europe. Yeah, that matters. Indeed, one of Rousset's first publications was a translation of freethinking works by Collins and Toland. The link between the Knights and organized Freemasonry and one of its main continental leaders, Rousset, rests in a variety of evidence, both personal and intellectual. By the 1750s, Rousset and Marchand were old men, and the original members of the Knights of Jubilation were long dispersed. Toward the end of their lives, Rousset wrote with affection and candor to Marchand about the religion of nature, and as Rousset called it in letter, his pantheism. But really, you're seeing the creator of the universe expressed in everything around it, in life, in the universe, pantheism. But the open use of the word with its blatantly atheistic associations was rare, as well as it is historically important. The word belonged to Toland. He had first used it in 1705 to describe his creed, and few would openly acknowledge their allegiance to such a secular and heretical creed unless they were conversing privately with somebody deeply sympathetic, and if not converted. In their last years, Rousset also asked Marchand to salute a mutual friend by the fraternal number, that is, the ritual Masonic manner of a triple embrace. This was the same form of address Rousset used in his correspondence with his lodge brothers and From it, we conclude that Marchand, once a playful knight in 1710, had somewhere along the line become a faithful brother. The fact that the leading Freemason in Amsterdam was also a self-described pantheist shows his deep familiarity with English free thinking, as transmitted by John Tolan. Freemasonry originated in England, and so too did free thinking, as the term was used in the early 18th century to describe Tolan and Tyndale and his associate Anthony Collins, who popularized it in a titled Discourse of Free Thinking that he published in 1713. Tolan knew the knights. How else did he get their private meeting record and leave it among his manuscripts? And Broussard embraced the religion of nature which Tolan had made famous, or most precisely, infamous. Well, that wraps it up, my goodness. And we're going to have to talk about the interconnectedness of things, of ideas. You know, I just had a wonderful conversation with a brother yesterday who we were talking about, you know, the shift away from combustible engines toward electrical systems and just how much, you know, even where I am, if we all plugged into electric cars tomorrow, our entire grid would collapse. We just need to think of how we're going to produce that much more clean, so-called clean energy. And of course, we're looking at, you know, small nuclear reactors technology and reactor technology and nuclear reactors in general. So expect a proliferation of that kind of thinking. But in the meantime, we have work to do and our scientists do. So make sure our children have the best opportunities they can, make sure they're healthy in mind, body, and spirit, because they're going to help us find answers to what we couldn't. And it's always been that way. Thank you very much for tuning in, though. Thank you. I hope it's been entertaining and it's been good for you, and that you'll find your way back here in a few days. Meanwhile, heads up. There's lots going on, and reason to be optimistic. Yeah, absolutely. The order is where I am. It is going through, I'll call it a metamorphosis. All good. It's all absolutely good. But we're now looking at, I think, a realization that the scale of our theories matters. And some of the laws and the parameters of Masonry are quite precise if we take into account the scale. In other words, we have that, you know, some rules that work well in nano research that don't work well in larger systems. So come back. I think it'll be good. I have a good program coming up. What part is in play? I think really rounds off to the edges of some of these, you know, tougher questions that we're facing in masonry. And I always want to pay homage to those beautiful landscapes of Masonic thinking that are out there around. And you know where you are. And you know who you are. And the rest of us are enormously grateful. And I know you're too humble to need that kind of praise, but thank you. It's purpose and gives us a sense of growth. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and life goes on. See you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.